From the studios of WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, this is Eastern Standard. Hello, I'm John Hingsbergen. From 2002 to 2006, there was not one reported loss of a single person in Lexington to heroin. Even as recently as 2010, there was only one death reported from heroin overdose. To go from that to 22 in 2012 and 44 such deaths in 2013 is an issue. We're going to talk eventually here with Josh Nadzem. This became more than a societal issue for him, as one by one, several of the kids he grew up with were dying from this abuse of this drug. After some tireless digging through the wreckage of this epidemic, Josh began to piece together the clues, and we're going to talk to him in just a few moments. He's the author of a very significant layout on screen for Under Main, available at undermain.com, the article titled How Did We Get Here. You'll find that online. But we're going to talk with Josh about his motivation and what he has learned. But first, we're going to talk with Van Ingram, Executive Director for the Kentucky Office of Drug Control Policy. Van, of course, at the center of what's going on in this area and actually throughout the Commonwealth as far as drug control. So Van Ingram, you have a background in law enforcement from Maysville, came into this position in the Office of Drug Control 10 years ago or so. Where does heroin fit into the picture in Kentucky?
Well, heroin is our latest struggle. When I first came to the office in 2004, methamphetamine was taking up the energy in the room. We had 1,000 meth labs and growing, and that was one of the first pieces of legislation I worked on. Shortly after that, prescription pills became the dominant item in the news and the thing that was taking the most attention in Frankfort as far as substance abuse issues go. And we find ourselves in 2012 starting to see some shifts. It's really not surprising. We've had an opioid problem for years. Heroin's just another opiate.
How did this shift become evident to you? What alarms went off, or what notices did you get?
Yeah. One of the most popular drugs in Kentucky was OxyContin before it was reformulated to make it more tamper resistant. And Josh mentions this in his article, that the popularity with OxyContin was to crush it and then either snort it or inject it. So understand OxyContin is an extended-release medication. So when you crush it and snort it or inject it, you get 12 hours worth of medication to your brain immediately. So when OxyContin changed that formulation in 2010, we saw a little small uptick in heroin, especially in the northern Kentucky region. But the big shift was to a drug called Opana. Opana was another extended-release product. Well, in 2011, they changed their formulation, and they went to a tamper-resistant formulation. Again, we saw another uptick in heroin. Then fast forward to the latter half of 2012, and we passed a pretty major piece of legislation dealing with prescription drugs, and that has also fueled this rise in heroin. But it's important to note that this has been coming for a while, and it's just not Kentucky. This is a problem all across the Midwest, New England, and is growing.
We're going to welcome now to the studio Josh. Josh.
Alex.
This is Alex. Alex is going to, planning to talk with you in a special segment that we're going to insert to the program. Still awaiting the arrival of Josh Nadzem, the author of this article, this piece on Under Main. It's under-main.com. But Van Ingram of the Office of Drug Control Policy, I understand I was here in Kentucky in 2012 when the pill mill bill was passed. There's a relationship, you think, between action taken by the legislature and the problem that now exists with heroin abuse?
There is some relationship. It's not a cause and effect type of relationship. Oh, we did this, so now we have this. According to the DEA threat assessment, a report of 2013, in 2008, Mexican drug cartels started increasing their shipments of heroin into the United States. From 2008 to 2012, seizures along the southwest border increased fourfold, quadrupled in 4 years. So if we're seizing four times as much, you have to think at least four times as much as getting in. So they have flooded the market with this product. It's cheaper, and it's more available. Now imagine yourself as an opioid addict that's used to pills. That takes some effort. You have to go fool a doctor or a dentist or someone to give you a prescription. You have to pay for that. You have a copay or full pay for the visit. You have to go to a pharmacy, get that prescription filled. That also costs money. Now we have this other alternative. For $10, I can go to my local drug dealer, buy a hit of heroin, and not have to go through all that. Hmm. So human nature plays a part in how we get here.
So this House bill, that this legislation, the pill mill bill, the idea was to do away with the illegal transfer and trade of what would be normally legal medications?
Well, you know, sometimes folks in the media like to attach a name to a piece of legislation, and we've got the pill mill bill. But the bill did a whole lot more mm-hmm. than regulate pain clinics. And the whole idea of the bill, from my standpoint, and I'm speaking only for myself, was to begin a shift in how we feel about these medications, opioid medications in this country and in this state. They are addictive. They are dangerous. They are also wonderful for acute pain. They're also wonderful for post-operative pain. The problem that I see comes when we use them for chronic non-cancer pain for long periods of time. People end up having problems. So we wanted really to change the way we feel about these drugs and just get to the point before a prescription is issued for an opioid pain medication that's a measured, conscious, deliberate decision between patient and practitioner, that it's not a casual decision. And that was the goal, really.
And was your office involved in recommending, endorsing, supporting that House bill?
Yes, we were very involved in the drafting and passage of that bill.
How do you feel about the results and the increase and the spike in heroin? As a result, is there a connection? Do you actually see a connection there?
There is some connection, but as I said earlier, I don't think it's a cause and effect type of connection. When the abuse of any substance occurs, four factors are always present, and it will always affect it. Price, can I afford this? Availability, can I find it? Perception of risk, do I feel like it'll harm me? And the last one is public attitude. So what we've seen in heroin is it's a cheaper price, it's become widely available, and for whatever reason, you know, when I was a young man, heroin would have been the last drug I'd have ever thought about using. I was just afraid of something like that. Unfortunately, we have a generation that didn't get that memo. Hmm. Don't have that inbred fear that you and I might have had.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Van Ingram is Executive Director for the Kentucky Office of Drug Control Policy. And in just a few moments, we are going to meet Josh, the writer of the article for under-maine.com. Undermaine is online at under-maine.com. The explosion of heroin in Lexington is our topic. We're interested in hearing from you. We'll open the lines in a little while, but you can send us an email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com, or send a tweet with your question at WEKUEST. That email address again, WEKUEasternstandard@gmail.com. Eastern Standard continues on WEKU.
I hit the city and I lost my band. I watched the needle take another man. Gone, gone, the damage done.
For some of us of a generation, this song pretty much told the story of heroin abuse, or at least was certainly out there as one of the pieces that kind of laid the case for the fact that this is a problem. And as we understand it, heroin abuse is exploding or has exploded in Lexington. This is Eastern Standard. I'm John Hingsbergen with guests in the studio and asking you to consider sending in a question. If you have one for our guest, you can do it by email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com, or send us a tweet at WEKUEST. Josh Nadzem wrote an article for Undermain online at under-main.com. It's an online publication, I guess. And Josh did this series, and actually, or not a series, but it's a, how do you even describe it, Josh?
It's a one-page, one-issue kind of article.
It's a big one-page.
Yeah. And that was the tough thing is, you know, with the heroin, there's so many different, it's so complex. It was the one of the challenges was finding where to cut it off. And
it's called How Did We Get Here? And it is prominent on the top of that website. And how did you get here, Josh? How did you get to writing and preparing this? And what is your interest in heroin abuse?
Well, the way I got involved is I don't have any personal use history or anything like that. But unfortunately, I have a lot of friends and kids that I grew up with who have already died from heroin overdose. And I'm 25 years old, so a lot of my friends didn't even make it to 25. You know, kids dying at 22 and 20 and that. So I was just really bothered by it and wanted to figure out what was going on. And, you know, people were always talking about how bad things are getting, how bad the world's getting. Well, I figured, well, let's figure out why and what can we do about it. I might not be able to do everything, but I can at least do my part and figure out what the heck is going on here.
Your background as a journalist, you've written and done other investigations of this type?
Actually, to be honest, this is my first time. So my personal background is I studied social work in college. I got my master's in social work. So I'm very experienced in this field of, I guess, community and helping others, so I tried to apply that tactics.
How did you approach putting this piece together? What does one do when you want to meet heroin addicts or talk to folks who are dealing with the heroin addiction?
Well, the way it started is Christine Huskinson with Undermain approached me. We got to know each other pretty well through Engage Lex, which is with Progress Lex, a fellowship program, and talked about writing an article because I expressed interest and said, you know, that I knew people who had died. And so we got to talking about writing an article, and I just kind of put it out there. I started with Facebook. I said, hey, I'm writing this article, so if you or anyone you know has been affected by this and you want me to help get your message out there, I'd be glad to meet with you and do anything I can. Just really, I wanted people to basically use me as the messenger to get the message out so we could do something. So really started with Facebook. People started connecting me to people, and then I got messages from people. And then I really started, I worked with Sharon Tankersley with Drug Free Lex, and so I started meeting with her. She's a part of the heroin task force in Lexington, and then she connected me to Alex Elswick, who was really helpful and inspiring, and his story, and it just kind of worked like that. And then Tom Martin with Undermain.com connected me to Van Ingram, and he was fantastic in helping me, and that's kind of how it spread.
You got out there, you took pictures, did you do some videos? I mean, we get a whole bunch of materials, supportive materials in this piece that, of course, years ago were not possible in investigative reporting, certainly not in print journalism.
Yeah, and I tried to figure out what the best way to convey the message was. So the article has text, but then also some pictures and some video as well, because I really wanted to figure out, you know, we always hear statistics, and sometimes we're bombarded with statistics, so I wanted to see who are the faces behind these numbers. And of course, I would make sure everyone was comfortable with being on video and being online. And everyone was thrilled about it, especially, for example, Katie Dunn. She lost her brother to heroin. So this was a way for her to honor him. And so I tried to use a lot of different multimedia approaches.
We're going to get to meet Alex Elswick, maybe not for our listeners on Thursday morning, but we're certainly going to get to meet him in the online archived version of this program and the repeat that will play on Sunday evening on WEKU. But put a face on heroin abuse for us right now, Josh. Tell us, who are the people being affected by this problem?
Well, one of the scariest things that I learned that was pretty consistent in everyone I interviewed was that it doesn't discriminate. It doesn't care about your race, gender, socioeconomic status. It's really ripping apart the city. And so especially in the suburban neighborhoods, I've interviewed people who grew up in the best of situations with perfect families and a lot of money and resources. And I've also interviewed people who grew up in really bad situations. I think that's the scariest thing, is it's hard to put a face on it because it's affecting everybody. So many people are falling fall into it. So that's one of the challenges. But for the most part, it's really rocking kids my age, really affecting, you know, the young 20s, early 30s. I'd say that that's the prominent group.
Have you met, did you interview people who are current users?
No, I was kind of worried about that. I didn't want to affect their treatment or their journey. So I tried to be sensitive to that. And I talked with a lot of people who do street outreach, who help people who are currently using it. But I didn't want to exploit their current situation or their addiction. And I just tried to be sensitive about it.
Are there heroes in the Lexington area, people who are making a difference or across Kentucky?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot. I think Alex Ellswick is somebody who, for example, I can do as much studying and research as I can, but I'll never know what it's like to actually be addicted. So somebody like Alex, who has overcome such traumatic experiences with being addicted to heroin, now he can go and help other people. I can try to help other people who are addicted, but I can never relate to them in a way that somebody like Alex can. And Sharon Tankersley, who's out there every day just working on this, and Alex's mom, and all sorts of people like that who are really just every day. In the article is Rob Morgan. So he is a well-known street activist. He's out there handing out clean needles to people, talking to people, trying to get people in treatment programs. I've met a lot of people who are just every day fighting this cause, and it's really inspirational.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. You can send us an email, WEKUEasternstandard@gmail.com, or send a tweet at WEKUEST. Let me go ahead and open up the phone lines. Now, we have a different phone number than what we normally give to our listeners this week because of the fund drive at WEKU, 859-622-1664. That's 622-1664 to be part of this week's Eastern Standard. We'll get to some calls if we have some listeners who would like to speak with questions or comments or tell their stories in just a little bit on this week's Eastern Standard. Again, that's 859-622-1664. WEKU Eastern Standard is the email address, and WEKUEasternstandard@gmail.com. We'll get to at least one email that is waiting here now. We're talking with Josh Nedzam, who's written this piece, How Did We Get Here?, published online. Under-Maine.com is where you can see it, videos and support materials, pictures, and so forth. The results of how much time, how long did it take putting this piece together?
It took quite a while, to be honest. I started back in July, just started gathering interviews and doing hours and hours of interviews, recording interviews, and then going back and listening to those interviews, especially with the video, trying to edit it in a good way. So I'd say, you know, about 3 months of work and editing and going back and forth with the editors.
Wow. Ben Ingram, as the executive director for the Kentucky Office of Drug Control Policy, how do you approach this kind of a media effort to address a problem like this? Did you immediately embrace this idea when you were approached by Josh?
Oh, absolutely. The biggest tool we have is public education. I talked about the perception of risk and how too many people didn't feel that perception of risk. Pieces like Josh is doing, Alex out here telling his story, helps heighten that awareness that this is a risky behavior. This is a behavior that often leads in death. So public education is huge. You know, we changed a lot of attitudes around prescription opiates, and a lot of that, I think, was due to the media attention that it got. So this is a very important effort. We appreciate you doing this show. Appreciate Josh's efforts. And we got to continue to keep talking about this. The problem doesn't... I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say that we do have an email that I'm going to go ahead and toss this at you, Van, because this came in from Elizabeth, who writes, the gentleman said this generation doesn't have the innate fear of heroin that his generation did. How can they, if they have been told that marijuana is a Schedule I drug but hasn't killed anyone and can help alleviate symptoms of thousands of diseases, how can a teenager or anyone else believe people who perpetuate these lies?
Well, it's just not me talking about the risk. It's just not government talking about the risk. You know, it's people like Josh. It's people like Alex, people who have lived this that are out there talking about these risks. So, you know, I can understand maybe not believing me, but these other folks that are talking up, They have no reason to be telling you something's not right.
Okay, I know you're in a position that deals with such matters and probably have a different position than many other people, but there are those who believe that marijuana is not a big deal. And is it, from your point of view, is there a wide difference between marijuana and the heroin abuse? And I think that's what Elizabeth is addressing, is we say, oh, well, marijuana is not a big deal, but the heroin is, and how can you trust someone who says that?
Well, no, I don't believe that there's near the risk with marijuana as there is prescription opiates or heroin.
And, do you see a connection? I mean, would your job be easier if marijuana were more popular as the drug of choice?
Well, certainly it would probably result in fewer deaths, but there'll be other issues associated with that as well.
Josh Nadsom, having written this piece on heroin in Lexington, what did you learn about other drug abuse and, you know, for instance, use of marijuana?
Well, just to piggyback on what Van is saying in the email, the thing I learned is that nobody I interviewed, no families I interviewed, no statistics I read, did anybody wake up and suddenly they were a heroin user. Nobody went from never using any drugs in their life to thinking, I'm going to inject heroin. So when I was growing up, it was kind of cliche to always say, oh, the gateway drugs. You know, in DARE class, we were always talking about gateway drugs. But the thing I learned is a lot of people who were starting using marijuana were using it as a way to either cope with something or to get away or to find some what they thought was normal. And so once that stopped alleviating their problems, then they needed something stronger. So it's really, even though it's cliche, it really looks like it's the gateway drug. So nobody goes from nothing to heroin. There seems to be a lot of things that lead to it.
The idea of using something to alter your mood means you might try something else.
Yeah, that's what I found. So my whole thing is I wanted to figure out literally how did we get here. So how did we get from almost no heroin deaths a few years ago to 44 last year? And that was the big thing, you know, whether it was the pill abuse that got shut down and all of a sudden shifts to heroin. It's just a lot of people were figuring out a way to escape. And, you know, whether marijuana was no longer strong enough or they couldn't get access to pills, it was one of the ways that led to heroin.
Van Ingram, in a minute's time before our next station break here, what is being done? What are you doing? And what are law enforcement officials or others in Kentucky doing to address this heroin issue?
Well, we talked about the public education, so I'm doing a lot of these kind of events. We had a bill last year in the last General Assembly that addressed a number of issues around heroin, had some harm reduction features to it, had some increased penalties for major traffickers. So we'll be working on a similar version of that in the next session of the General Assembly and try to impact the best we can there.
So we're going to see legislation in the next session in 2015.
I believe that we will.
This is Eastern Standard, and we are talking the explosion of heroin in Lexington. The piece that we're talking about that Josh Nadsom wrote is an online article and an investigative report, I think we can call it. How did we get here? At under-main.com is where you'll find it. And we will have this program, by the way, posted and put some links to the article now that it is up and running. Just published. Was it just put online this week?
Yes. Actually, last night was the official release.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. This is a segment of the program that listeners did not hear live on Thursday morning because of fundraising underway at WEKU. But this topic is so important. We really want to get a chance to meet someone whose life has been personally affected by heroin and learn his story. With us now is Alex Elswick, an ex-addict. And that's all I know about you so far, Alex. Tell me more about Alex.
Well, I'm just privileged to be here. I really appreciate you guys having me on.
We're grateful.
And I guess my story in 30 seconds or less is I come from very privileged circumstances. And I think that's important as I go to share my story, because when I got into a drug addiction, I had every available resource to get clean and to get treatment. And still I found it very difficult to navigate that process. And I just want to take every opportunity to raise awareness to the issue and to give people a chance to get their lives back.
You're from the Lexington area?
I am, born and raised.
Where'd you go to school?
Went to Henry Clay High School and then Center College.
Talk about how heroin came into your life.
I think Josh's article is, first of all, I just encourage everybody to go read it. It's a phenomenal article. It's I told Josh earlier today, the tone is very on point. I think it's just, he's really taken the temperature of the issue and he understands it well. So he outlined the issue well. For me, it did begin with marijuana. I think all my life I felt a void. I felt abnormal, sort of. And the first time that I used drugs and alcohol, I felt normal. It restored some sense of normalcy, some semblance of what I thought I should feel like, and it just progressed. It's such a gradual process. Before I knew it, I was experimenting with other drugs. I had elective surgery, had wisdom teeth taken out, and was prescribed oxycodone, and that was really where my addiction began. I was taking it as prescribed, and it just grabbed a hold of me.
Is that the same drug that talk show host Rush Limbaugh got hooked on because of back trouble or something? So, I mean, marijuana certainly played a role, but, I mean, which was more significant for you, marijuana or the oxycodone that came through medical purposes?
Certainly, I'd say oxycodone. See, oxycodone is a remarkable drug, but it was developed not for mild or moderate pain, for cancer patients who are trying to get through chemotherapy for extreme, extreme pain. And so we're not talking about abusing some small pain medication like a 5 milligram oxycodone. Oxycodone is so strong, and it definitely was the gateway for me because I had no idea that there were any potential consequences. My doctor prescribed it to me. I have put faith in my doctor that he gives me something that's healthy for me. And 2 years later, I'm a full-blown drug addict.
So tell us, I know I'm sure it's not real easy to tell this story because we're talking about a part of your life that is behind you, one, and two, I'm sure must have been painful, at least getting out of it. How did that happen? How do you get to heroin? Where does it come from? And all of a sudden, you didn't just take oxycodone and the next week you're a heroin addict.
No, that's right. First, I should mention I'm a little over a year clean today, which is a miracle.
Wow, congratulations.
By the grace of God and power of treatment and recovery programs. So hope is possible. You can change. There's light in the darkest places. I want to say that. But for me, what happened was I slowly became addicted to Oxycontin. I was buying it on the street, but I was still in school and I was making decent grades. I went into my senior year and...
In college,
yeah.
Did you say Center College?
Center College, and I'm going for, I was going for a double major. I was making good grades. I still see, the denial is so strong with this disease. It's just concomitant with the disease, and I had no idea, I had no concept of how deep I was in. And so then after a few treatments for oxycodone, and I would get out and relapse, and I struggled, someone introduced me to heroin as a cheaper and more available alternative, frankly.
Schoolmate, a bum on the street? I mean, how does that happen?
It was a suburban kid. It was a suburban kid who's an intelligent kid, and that's, I think, very much, as Josh said, in many ways the face of the heroin problem in Kentucky. Certainly, it doesn't discriminate. That's a great point. It can happen to anybody, but I think predominantly it's young, white, suburban males.
We're going to come back to Alex Elswick in just a moment and talk about how he has overcome his heroin addiction, at least for a year. We're celebrating that now. Josh Nadzem, in terms of writing this piece, where did you come into contact? How did you meet up with Alex?
Well, for me, I had known Sharon Tankersley from different community work, and she's involved in Drug Free Lex and the Heroin Task Force. So I approached her about this article and saying that I was really interested in it and could you help me? So she gave me her perspective from a professional standpoint and then said, you should really meet Shelly, who's Alex's mom. And then I met with her and she gave her perspective, of having a son so affected by this. And she said that Alex would be open to me approaching him and writing about it. And that was something I was really hoping to do, is that we can talk about numbers all day, we can talk about theories and science and everything, but until you hear personally from somebody who's been affected, I don't think you can really understand it. And so that was something I do. And Alex was really open and flexible and cool with me doing videos and everything. So that's how we linked up.
How many people similar to Alex did you speak with?
A lot. So, like I said, one person would lead me to another person and so on. And next thing I know, I was sitting at the Hope Center in Lexington, who does all sorts of fantastic work for drug treatment. And I was sitting in a circle of 79 men who are fighting to overcome addiction. A lot was alcoholism, but a significant amount was also heroin.
79
men.
And those men, age range, race-wise, status in society?
For me, one of the scariest things about it was just seeing how broad it was. I mean, I saw people that were my age, I'm 25, and I'm looking across at them and just wondering, how did this happen? How did our lives go such different paths? And then all the way to, I saw somebody who was at least in their 70s. And, well, I mean, the tough part, too, is that you could see somebody who's 40 and from drug abuse and on the streets, they could look 60 or 70. But it was just unreal to be sitting there and realize just, these are the people behind the statistics. I'm sitting there literally with 79 people, and that's just one of their classes. And they were very open and receptive to me sitting in on it. And I was very thankful for the Hope Center.
Any impression that did you get in your reporting about the success rate of treatment options and how when people go to seek help, how likely are they to recover?
As far as statistics, I didn't have any strong statistics in that regards, but you know, some of the things I learned was that there's going to be failures. Some of the people like Alex and others who have overcome it triumphantly didn't do it on their first time. They've been through various treatment programs, and so I think that was one thing that was consistent in messages is from families and friends is to realize that it's going to be tough and that you might not succeed your first time, but don't give up, and especially for the families, don't give up on these people because they may fail the first three times, but the fourth time that they may rise above it.
Alex Ellswick, okay, oxycodone, medicinal prescribed medicine that you began taking. You gradually migrated into using heroin. What caused you to end up getting help?
Heroin, I immediately started using intravenously, and it's just
needles.
Needles. And it's a very different addiction. It becomes even darker. If I couldn't have imagined it, but it became even darker.
No hesitation putting a needle into your own arm.
None whatsoever. As Josh alluded to earlier in the segment, it's a pathology of the brain, and it affects the reward pathway such that, basically anything that can get me back to normal, back to, okay, that it will take away the withdrawals is good. My heroin addiction took me the last day that I shot heroin. I was under a bridge in Dayton, Ohio. And the reason that it's important that I share that detail is because the jump from where I was a year ago under a bridge shooting heroin in Dayton with a few homeless people to where I am today, it just shows that if you don't give up on somebody, if you give them another chance and another chance and another chance, maybe they'll show you something. Because it's like Josh said, relapse, the last statistics that I've seen, and we always have to be wary of statistics, but 86% relapse rate for heroin addicts. Those are formidable odds.
What got you to treatment? What did you get arrested? Was there a low point, I guess, similar to alcoholism? You get to a point where you have no other option but to go up?
You know, to be perfectly candid, I stole from the girl that I was living with at the time. I stole something of sentimental value, and she kicked me out, and it's the greatest thing that ever happened to me because everybody did what some people refer to as detaching with love. They could no longer support my addiction. They would no longer enable me, and it left me under a bridge in Dayton, and it left me at a place where I said, something's got to change, and I'm finally willing to go through something very difficult in order to change, and I checked myself into a Salvation Army treatment center in Dayton, Ohio. That's free, and it changed my life.
What happened? What was done in treatment that got you off of heroin?
So the most important thing is really simple and obvious, and it's the fact that you're locked away from the street. But the crucial difference, I mean, the reason why you can't just lock somebody in prison is because they have a pathology of the brain that has so many different behavioral cognitive elements that need to be addressed and treated. That's not going to happen in prison. In treatment, it's peer-based, like Van alluded to, but also the counseling addresses so many of the underlying issues, psychological issues, dual diagnosis like anxiety and depression, and it gave me an opportunity to learn how to live without using drugs as a crutch.
In just 1 minute's time, what do you think needs to be done in Lexington or across the Commonwealth to eliminate or at least reduce the problem with heroin addiction? And these 44 deaths happened in 2013.
I think a lot of what Van mentioned is very important about Senate Bill 5. I hope we see that again, because the needle exchange program, the naloxone program, so many of these things are so important. But more than anything, for my part, what I want people to understand is that the perception that society has needs to change. These are not bad people trying to get good. These are sick people trying to get well.
What are you doing personally besides participating in a story like this written by Josh to spread the gospel, as it were, of getting off of heroin?
I spend a lot of time going around to different treatment centers and sharing my story, sharing my testimony. The 12-step program that I work, we call it Sharing Experience, Strength, and Hope. And that's what I want to do. I just want people to know that no matter how far down the scale you've gone, you can recover.
Alex Ellswick, thank you so much for being so open and telling your story and allowing our listeners to hear it. And again, congratulations on what you have accomplished and the great future ahead of you.
Thank you so much.
859-622-1664, 859-622-1664 is the phone number if you'd like to interact with Josh or Van Ingram. And likewise, send us an email at WEKUEST on Twitter, and the email WEKUEasternstandard@gmail.com. We'll be back in a moment on the WEKU's Eastern Standard.
And the damage done, a little part of it in everyone, but every junkie's like a setting sun.
It's Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. I'm John Hingsbergen, and my guests for this portion of the program are Van Ingram, Executive Director of the Kentucky Office of Drug Control Policy, and Josh Nadsom, who wrote a piece for the online publication Undermain, under-main.com. And listeners on Sunday evening, as well as to our online podcast, we'll get to hear more from Alex Ellswick, an ex-addict. We will take some time to chat with him and make sure that that is part of the conversation you have access to. We ask you to feel free to be part of the program by sending us an email, WEKUEasternstandard@gmail.com. Send a tweet at WEKUEST. And if you'd like to call in and interact with Josh or Van, 859-622-1664. This is a special number for this week's Eastern Standard. That's 859-622-1664. If you'd like to be part of today's program, we're here for another 15 minutes or so. Van and Josh, one of the things that we've heard of for years are efforts of society to kind of cope with heroin use. I think that's how we best describe it. Needle exchanges and methadone treatment plans, needle exchanges certainly are not a treatment.
No, they're not, but they are a harm reduction measure. And what you're looking for with a syringe exchange program is better health outcomes. The rates of hepatitis C in Kentucky have just increased dramatically over the last several years. Every needle that's found in a park, that's found in a parking lot, that has the potential to stick someone, has the potential to spread disease. So that's part of the equation. The other part, and I visited a syringe exchange program yesterday in Portsmouth, Ohio, and they also distribute naloxone, which is a drug that can circumvent a drug overdose. But what they told me was, when people decide to get treatment, the first place they go is the person at the syringe exchange program. That's somebody they've built a rapport with. That's somebody they trust. That's somebody that can help them navigate the drug treatment, substance abuse treatment world.
Who runs those exchange programs?
In Ohio, it's public health.
Is there such a program in Kentucky?
There is not. We would need a change in statute to be able to do that.
Is there a proposal to make that
happen? There was in Senate Bill 5, there was an amendment that would have allowed for that. But as I say, that bill didn't pass. But I would not be surprised to see it appear again.
Tell me about methadone. I don't hear much about methadone. Years ago, we heard about that as a radical approach to kind of easing people off of heroin.
Yeah, you know, this is our third run at heroin in the United States. The first one was right around the turn of the century when Bayer Aspirin Company marketed heroin as a pain reliever. We learned better of that, and then heroin came back in the 70s. And it was found that methadone was a drug that could keep a person stable, would keep them from those highs and lows of heroin, and they could dose, take it every day, and have improved quality of life, be able to work, be able to take care of their families by going into a clinic and dosing once a day. We had these programs start up in Kentucky. One was in, I think the first one was in Louisville. There are now 14 different methadone stations around Kentucky, and they serve about 4,500 people. Then there's another drug called buprenorphine, sold as Suboxone, or Subutex, that also has the same goal of keep taking it away from the highs and lows and keeping it at a steady, even pace and keep them from getting sick. And then, of course, we have 18 or 19 or so recovery programs in Kentucky that take a different approach, that take an abstinence approach. And usually those are a long-term living situation. People are there for 6 months or more. And it's based on a peer-led recovery, addicts helping other addicts. And those are programs that have been very successful as well.
Van, you come from a law enforcement background, again, a former police chief and police officer in Maysville, Kentucky, into this position at the Office of Drug Control Policy. Is there a temptation to find a way to lure people in and make sure they get arrested and that the appropriate consequences of society be meted out? Or has your mindset shifted from law enforcement to something else?
Well, locking up addicts for a long period of time is not a very smart use of resources. We're much better off to help them in their treatment than we are wholesaling people in jails that are addicts. Now, that being said, I don't have a lot of use for drug traffickers, people who prey on the misery of others and peddle, whether it's cocaine or methamphetamine or whatever, or heroin, to other people. So there have been a number of measures in Kentucky to link up substance abuse treatment and the criminal justice system, drug courts being one example. Presumptive probation in possession cases is another. So we got. I think that's a more effective way, and that's something that we'll continue to work on.
Josh Nadsom is the writer of this piece, How Did We Get Here? You're approaching where the problem came from. Did you get into, in your piece, addressing how we can get out of here? How do we get back out of this problem of the explosion of heroin in Lexington?
Yeah, well, to add on to what Van said, a lot of people told me that the solution isn't just locking people up. What I learned is once you're addicted to something, whether it's heroin or food or cigarettes or anything, the structure of your brain literally changes chemically, physically, it changes. So to just put someone behind bars and expect that they're just going to walk out and no longer be addicted is just, like Van said, really a waste of resources and taxpayers' money trying to lock people up. So a lot of states do the needle exchange programs. I've heard that they've been very successful, not only in reducing HIV and hepatitis spreading, but also starting that conversation with people and building that rapport. And especially if the people distributing the clean needles are former users. For example, Nick Britton is somebody who I interviewed in the article. He now works at the Hope Center. He's a former user, and now he helps other people. Like I said, if it's one thing to hear it from me, but if you hear from somebody who says, look, man, I've been there, I know how dark it is, and I know how awful it is, and you can get through it, but here's what I did, that's just unbelievable in helping. So things like that are a big help.
Why are people dying? Why are people dying of heroin abuse? Is there something about heroin itself that is causing that fatal consequence?
That was something I also learned too, and I was curious. Is, you know, there's been all sorts of addictions to pills and alcohol and stuff, but it seemed like with heroin, people were dying, and that was the big thing. I was trying to figure out why, and a lot of people explained to me that with the pill addiction, if you bought 20 milligrams of oxycodone from John on the street or Bob on the street or Sally on the street, it's 20 milligrams from no matter who you get, you know the dose. But with heroin, these dealers are getting a supply and chopping it up and mixing with all sorts of things. So you never know how strong it is. So you may take it one time and it's way too powerful for you and you overdose and it kills you the first time. There was somebody who told me that somebody in Louisville died from it, and their heroin was actually mixed with concrete. So they're mixing it with all sorts of chemicals, just anything to make their supply stretch further so they could sell it more.
44 people died of heroin abuse in 2013. Any sense of this year so far, Van? Are those numbers a running toll?
Yeah, I get just looked at the first 6 months of 2014 this week. About steady, about even.
Same as last year.
As 2013, yeah. And it's important to note that although heroin is a huge problem in certain regions of the state, overall, statewide, prescription drugs are still the leading cause of overdose death. But what we see is with prescription drugs, and we see it with heroin, there are usually numerous drugs in the bloodstream of the person who's died of an overdose. Often Alprazolam or Xanax is present a great deal of the time, both with heroin and with prescription opiates. Alcohol is also present a lot with heroin, we see that, as well as other prescription opiates. So it's that combination of drugs that are causing so many people to lose their lives. And then as Josh alluded to, there's the purity issue. And then one of the most dangerous times is during a relapse, when someone's been clean for a while or they're getting out of jail or something like that, and their body has lost that tolerance that it had. They go back and try to use the same dose they were using before they were locked up or before they went into rehab. And that often proves to be a fatal dose.
Let's talk to one of our listeners. Bob from Lexington is on the line. He's called us at 859-622-1664. Bob, go right ahead.
Well, you all have pretty much gone over what I was going to say about the difference between heroin, which you have no idea what you're getting, and prescription opiates. And, at least in theory, you should know what you're getting. And the only way to to regulate heroin, I mean, you have to think outside the box these days in terms of eventual legalization of drugs, and where, you know, it can be much more highly regulated by the government. And it's not going to stop people from taking heroin, you know. It's unfortunate, but those are the realities. And so you have to think of other ways of fixing the problem.
Bob, good points. Let me pick up on that, and because we have a very short time remaining in today's program. Van Ingram, some nations, Denmark, Norway, drugs of the type heroin, for instance, are legal. Is that true?
There are some countries that have decriminalized drugs. Yes.
What does the research say about that in terms of its impact on the society in those communities?
You know, well, you look at the United States experience. What's our most used drug? Well, it's alcohol because it's legal, and it's tobacco because it's legal. And I see this on the internet. I hear it from people. When things are legal, the perception of risk that I talked about earlier goes down. And that, you know, we know scientifically that 10 to 15% of anybody that takes any drug is going to have problems with it, whether that's alcohol, whether it's heroin. There'll be a percentage that can use it casually. There's always going to be a percentage that can't. We don't need any more Kentuckians checking out. We don't need any more. We've got enough societal issues with substance abuse. We certainly don't need to do anything that's going to increase that.
Josh, having written this piece and doing this investigation, how do you feel about the future, the possibility of getting help for people who are being affected by heroin and our community?
From what I learned and from all the people I met who are doing this every day, I'm excited. I think that we just got to get it out there, and hopefully people go online to undermain.com and read this article, not for my benefit or to get my name out there, but just to hear the message. I'm just getting the message out there, so relaying what people have been through, what people have experienced, because these are the faces and the people and the names behind the numbers. So as long as we get the message out there and keep working together and admit that there's a problem and keep working, I'm excited about the future. It's going to be a long battle, but we can definitely do it.
Van Ingram, what can we look for in the legislature? What other activity can we see in the Commonwealth in the next year or two to address the heroin issue, and specifically focusing on Lexington?
Well, we got to raise awareness. We got to increase access to treatment. We got to increase the distribution of naloxone, a drug that can stop an overdose. You know, We want to get people into treatment. We want to get them into recovery. We can't do that if they're dead. So we want to be able to prevent as much overdose death as we can. So there's a lot of work to do, but I'm excited too because there's a lot of people willing to do it right now. And so I'm encouraged. We've had success in other battles. I think we will in this battle too.
We encourage our listeners to follow up for more information. Go to the WEKU website, weku.fm. As later today on Thursday, we'll have today's program posted as a podcast. We will have links to Josh's article at under-maine.com, How Did We Get Here?, addressing the explosion of heroin in Lexington. We'll make a connection to Van Ingram in the Office of Drug Control Policy as well. Gentlemen, thank you for being here on Eastern Standard.
Thank you, John.
WEKU Eastern Standard is an interactive program, and it is produced by a group of producers, Morgan Crutchfield, Logan Riley, Andrew Moorhead, and Richard Turner help put the program together every week. On the phones today was Morgan Crutchfield. We had help from Brian Bartlett as well. And we also want to say thanks to Tom Martin, who works with Undermain, for making this all happen for this week's Eastern Standard. The program in its more complete form will be available as a podcast at weku.fm and will also be repeated Sunday evening at 6 on the WEKU stations. Thank you for tuning in. I'm John Hingsbergen for WEKU.